Good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to see you all on this lovely summerish, fallish day, somewhere in between the spaces we all live. Good morning. I'd like to begin with an homage. Homages are important for me because what I am paying homage to are beings and teachers that support me and all of you sitting where we're sitting. Homage to the Buddhas and ancestors. Homage to the Dakota Nation whose lands we are guests. Homage to our teachers. Homage to our parents, to our relatives and friends. So today is the opening of the fall practice period. Yeehaw. So together, whether we our conditioned support taking the class or not, we will be studying the Eightfold Path together in many ways. And today I would like to speak about the path factors, specifically in relationship to right view. I've been practicing a lot with right view because I find that when I open up my heart and my mind, I'm also opening up to feedback from people, from friends, relatives, Sangha members, even associates. And that feedback is dynamic and supports the possibility of this mind cultivating right view. I would also like to say before I move forward with my understanding of right view at this time, I would like to express deep appreciation to the Sangha. In August, I've been working with several other people on developing a draft of a vision statement in relationship to racial justice. And I am deeply I offer deep gratitude for the feedback that was offered by the Sangha. We take the feedback very seriously. In fact, we continue to integrate and digest it. That's why I've not sent anything forward, because the feedback was very dynamic, and we want to honor everybody's voice and bring everybody's voice into this vision statement. So I do want to say that right now. And what that also sparked in me was the question of nonviolent direct action in relationship to racial justice in Buddhism? How do these practices intersect in space and time? And do they intersect in space and time? Is Zen Buddhism relevant to direct action? Is Zen Buddhism relevant to unraveling ancient twisted karma that we have in relationship to racial justice and social justice issues? These are important questions. They're historically important questions, and there are times within our conditions that the conditions seem to support an urgency in addressing and really investigating the questions. And I feel that urgency. And if not, why isn't Zen Buddhism relevant? And if it is, how is it? In August of this year, I also did a 9-day training at the Satyagraha Institute in the Black Hills. It was a 9-day training on Gandhian and King principles of nonviolence. It was very informative, and I feel transformational for me going forward in working with racial justice issues in relationship to nonviolence direct action. The transformational experience for me was, we cannot do this work alone. We can only do it in relationship to each other. And you'd think as a Zen priest, I would have an understanding of that. But I'm also human, as many of you have direct experience of. I'm working on it. My humanity. Bless my friends and relatives for their compassion. We can look back and say how we could have done things differently. But for me, the real challenge is demonstrating to you all my commitment through my actions beyond my words. So in this conversation, I would like to offer, and I do, even though I'm up here, blah, 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 talking to you, I feel like hopefully we are in conversation with each other, because this is not a passive experience. It's very dynamic. And I invite all of us in connection with each other in this conversation, and I do want to hear, if we don't have time today, maybe after, well, we have a lot of celebrations today, but I do want to hear your thoughts, your ideas, what you're doing in relationship to this conversation. It's a dialogue, it's a conversation, it's done in connection. So the first factor of the Eightfold Path, support the right view, supports the ability to respond to conditions in a balanced way with a flexible mind and open heart. The response is interconnected to all beings. All beings being two-legged, four-legged, winged, crawly, all beings. All beings are with us. And the environment, the sun, the wind, all the elements. This relationship is the heart of nonviolent direct action and is foundational to Buddha's teaching of inter-co-arising, interdependency. The Eightfold Path, I just want to name what the Eightfold Path is, because you'll be studying it, but I just want to bring it forward. The first factor in the Eightfold Path is right view. Second, right intention. Third, right speech. Fourth, right action. Fifth, right livelihood. Sixth, right effort. And seventh, right mindfulness. And eighth is right concentration. The path in the Eightfold Path is not linear or sequential. If I get right view, then I'm going to get right effort. That's not exactly what the practice is. Each factor is embedded in each component, and all the factors working together support the strengthening of the path, of the way. Within the path is the relative. So right view in the relative is kind of what would appear sometimes as common sense. At first glance, there's a little example of, at first glance, when I look and I just see out of the corner of my eye, look, oh, I see a snake. I'm like, whoa. And then I look closer. Oh, it's a rope. So right view in that sense is in the relative. Seeing things as they are, the appearances as they appear. Then there's the right view in the absolute. Within the Eightfold Path, there are three groups, and we've talked about these groups before. One is the moral discipline, which includes right speech, right action, right livelihood. The second is concentration, which includes right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. The third is wisdom, right view, right intention. So what we're really would like to cultivate is the wisdom. And we've talked a little bit about that. Prajnaparamita is the example of wisdom beyond wisdom, the practice of being able to go beyond ourselves, beyond what we consider wisdom or goodness. And the only way that that kind of wisdom can arise is through the practice of Zazen. Being able to study ourselves, to study ourselves in relationship to the world we're interacting in, to our day-to-day experiences with ourselves in relationship to community, to the environment. The training in the higher moral discipline is the relinquishing of self-centeredness. What to say, because I find myself that's one of the greatest practices for me, is to really let go of my ideas, let go of what I think is right and wrong, let go of what I think should happen. Is there anybody who is self-realized in here? I just want to make sure. If there is, please step forward. investigation of the self-centeredness, it's not compressing ourselves, right? I'm not good. I'm a piece of crap. I have no worth. That is not kindness. That is not compassionate. So how do we relax and practice with our self-centeredness? How do we invite compassion for ourselves in relationship to our self-centeredness? It's really, it's very significant that we ventilate the work that we do in relationship to studying ourselves and unraveling our self-centeredness, that we embed that and infuse that with compassion and love. Capital L-O-V-E. Love. And I actually learned that in the Black Hills. I kind of learned that growing up somewhat. But there are times in our lives when we relearn things. And I relearn the importance of love in relationship to racial justice and nonviolent direct action and Zen practice. Because Zen practice, I don't want to discourage anybody, so I'll watch what I say. I don't want to sugarcoat it either, so I'm kind of stuck in a corner here. Zen practice really calls us to look at ourselves and deconstruct. Deconstruct ourselves as we know ourselves to be in relationship to the culture that we live in. Because the culture we live in sometimes doesn't support being upright and being in alignment with what actions need to happen. And I'll get to that too. This training in moral development and relinquishing self-centeredness, that in itself could be a lifelong practice. Training in concentration. Concentration is a training. Sitting down and focusing the mind and inviting the mind to be one-pointed. Not an easy task for those of us who have participated in meditation, even for 2 minutes, trying to get the mind to quiet down. And then the training of the higher wisdom, wisdom beyond wisdom. I would like to share with you the 3 types of wisdom. One is the wisdom that arises from listening. Just listening to people, when people give me feedback or give you feedback, oh, that wasn't very nice. Ooh. So instead of turning away, oh, that's on you. Turn towards that person. Okay, that wasn't nice. Let's talk about it. So it's a deep listening to people, opening the mind, opening the heart. Then there's the wisdom that arises from contemplation, reflection, insight, just reflecting on oneself in relationship to one's life or one's family, one's friends, community. That reflection is important in relaxing into it. So it's not like a tense reflection, like already I already got an idea at the end how I want this reflection to turn out. It's a reflection of don't know mind. I don't know how this reflection is going to turn out. I don't know where this insight's going to lead me. And I'm open. I'm open. And then there's the wisdom that arises from meditation. And that's what we call, some of us call emptiness. That's what some of us call deconstruction of the world as we know it. There are many gifts that come out of meditation and sitting in silence. The path emerges and intersects with higher training, and each training supports and increases the spiritual stability of the other. In the middle discourse of the Buddha, there's a book, Majjhima Nikaya. It's a book on what the Buddha said. In the middle discourse in Sutta 117, the Buddha states, bhikkhus are like monks, nuns, I shall teach you noble right concentration, which supports and its requisites. What, bhikkhus, is the noble right concentration with its supports and its requisites? That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness. Unification of the mind equipped with these seven factors is called the noble right concentration, which supports and requisites. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong view as wrong view and right view as right view. This is one's right view. So let me just say that again. One understands wrong view as wrong view and right view as right view. This is one's right view. The Buddha goes on to explain what right view is, what wrong view is. Wrong view, nothing given, no generosity, nothing offered, no generosity, nothing sacrificed, there's no skin in the game, no fruit or result of good and bad action. There's nothing happening. Right view, twofold. So there's the relative, the world that we live in, and then there's the noble path, the path of liberation. The relative is affected by taints. It's affected by hindrances, things that cloud our mind, delusions, greed, anger, and ignorance. And so these hindrances affect how we see the world. This greed, anger, and ignorance affects how we see the world. And what we do in the relative is we work with them to correct them, to support right view. In the noble path, is the path of liberation. In order to work with the right view and wrong view, we must develop insight and discernment into wholesome and unwholesome actions and their impact. Unwholesome impact, greed, anger, and ignorance results in suffering. Wholesome seeds, non-greed, generosity, non-hatred, compassion, and non-ignorance, wisdom, support the possibility of liberation for ourselves and for all beings. Because if we're liberated and we're free, everyone is free. Bhikkhus Bodhi, who is a Theravadan monk who I've studied, talks about the implications of Buddha's teaching in relationship to right view. He says, implication of Buddha's teaching on the right view of actions and its fruit run counter to popular trends in present-day thought. The teaching on right view makes it known that good and bad, right and wrong, transcend conventional opinions about what is good and bad, what is right and wrong. To me, that is very, very important, that the Buddhist teachings transcends conventional, consensual opinions about what is good and bad. So that puts a responsibility on us to figure out for ourselves as individuals and collectively what is an appropriate response given these conditions, because the conditions are continuously changing and sometimes they're continuously dynamic, and it's mind-blowing. And how do we develop spiritual stability to stay in these conditions and respond in a way that is compassionate and has wisdom? An entire society may be predicated upon a confusion of correct moral values. And even though everyone within the society may applaud one particular kind of action as right and condemn another as wrong, this does not make them validly right and wrong. I think that's so important because that really supports and frees us up in developing right view. And if consensual reality is saying you are wrong, that might not be the case. You might be the voice in the wilderness saying, no, you're wrong. What you're doing is not kind. What you're doing is cruel. And I'm not going to stand up in that. I'm going to stand up here in compassion and wisdom. And you know what? I may be alone. I may look like I'm alone, but I'm not alone. Because you know what? I got the 10,000 Buddhas at my back. I got the ancestors saying, GD, you stand up. We taught you. This is your moment. You stand up for compassion, for wisdom. That's the practice. And if you're scared, it's okay, because you're not alone. Stand up. So I think this is what the practice does, right? The practice supports us standing up in the fire when everybody else is saying, you're wrong, you're not seeing it right. Well, guess what? I've been practicing right view. I've been practicing compassion and wisdom. And you know what? I'm trusting my feelings, because I've been sitting with this mind. I've been letting go of my selfishness, my self-centeredness. I'm free. And I know I'm committed to the Bodhisattva vow. That vow says, I serve all beings because I believe in liberation and freedom for all beings. Not one particular kind of being or one particular kind of condition, for all beings. And I don't stand alone. I stand with the ancestors. So, I stand. And I invite you. I invite you, question. Question when people say, you're the only one who thinks that. I think you're wrong. Question them. Because we know. We understand some of our history because we've read it. We know what has happened when people haven't stood up. A lot of suffering. So, how does one discern what right view is in relationship to arising conditions? Oh man, I got 12 minutes. Okay, rock on. Okay. Because I wanted to hear from you as well. Oh, wow. Okay, I do want to talk about T. Marie King, who was a black activist at the Satyagraha Institute. And she talked to us a lot about being an ally, a good ally. And she brought forward 7 principles on how to be an ally, and I just want to bring them forward. She brought 1, listening, just being present, sitting in silence. 2, don't be shocked. Don't be shocked at what's happening with people today and what people are experiencing and what they're talking about. 3, educate yourself. What is the history of the place where you live and work and play? Learn that. 4, stop using colorblind. Color and race do exist in the relative. 5, what does your behavior say? What is your action saying in relationship to your words? 7, be accountable. Build trust. Be present. 7, listen. And so, in the beginning, we listen, we go through, and we listen even more. The listening is the beginning, in the middle, and in the end of practicing nonviolent direct action, and also cultivating right view. It is the call from silence. The silence is an active and dynamic experience. This silence is developed for me in Zazen. There are many ways to develop silence. Meditation and Zazen are a way that really support me developing silence. It is what Reb describes as remembering silence, receiving silence, practicing silence, and transmitting silence. This is the integration and transmission of silence in thought, speech, and action. It is active and dynamic. It is a complex combination of synergistic activity of all beings in the environment in the form of expressed love. Katagiri Roshi talked about this emptiness, this nothingness in his book, Each Moment is a Universe. I'd like to read it. We also, some of us studied Zenki with Roshi Byakuran a couple weeks ago, and she talked about total dynamic functioning, which is what we're doing right now, each one of us. Is we're totally dynamically functioning with each other within this environment, and it's awesome. Nothingness means total functioning, just functioning energy. When the present is no time, it is interconnected with all sentient beings in the peace and harmony of timelessness. But when nothingness functions, there is a pivot, and it becomes the present. That pivot is called the pivot of nothingness, At that precise point, the intersection of time and space, which is called now, right here, all sentient beings come together in the moment, and a vast world comes up, past, present, future, earth, trees, planets, moons, and suns. In each moment, every possible aspect of human life, everything we can be, spreads out, unfolds, and a huge world comes up. That is called independent co-origination. That's the Buddhist teaching of intersection, of interconnectedness, and compassion and wisdom for all of us. I want to share a story because I have 2 minutes. What does this look like, this interconnectedness in real time? So during a break at it's called a Genzo-e. It's a study, a tense study on a fascicle of Dogen. We studied Zenki, which is total dynamic functioning. In the afternoon, we had a little break. I'm like, I'm going to go outside, breathe some fresh air, just see what's happening in the outside world, outside of Zen. Because then I'm separating, right? Zen world, outside world, all same. So I go outside and I start walking. I'm in my robe. I start walking. I see kids playing in the park. And I go up there and they're like, what religion are you? I'm like, I'm Buddhist. They go, oh, do you meditate? I'm like, wow. I said, yeah. I said, I meditate in that building down there. And this young lad goes, how do you meditate? I said, do you have a minute? He said, yeah. There were three lads. I'm like, this is cool. So I said, okay. I said, I put my hand on my heart. I didn't ask them to put their hands on their heart, but they put their hands on their heart. I said, okay. I said, let's just find our breath. So I said, okay. I found my breath. I said, did you guys find yours? They're like, yeah. I'm like, oh, cool. So I said, let's just breathe. I said, okay, let's open our eyes. And they're like, that's meditation? I said, yeah. I said, they said, that's cool. I said, the one guy goes, that's more complex than what I thought. I'm like, it was so beautiful. This other guy goes, well, I don't know what my parents are going to say. I said, my name's Gentle Dragon Laura Kennedy. I said, invite your parents to come to the Zen Center. I said, we'll talk. I said, we got people your age coming to the Zen Center. I said, come. I said, and the young lad, he's like, he was just like, oh, this is so cool. He said, I feel so different. I'm like, that is so awesome, I mean. So that's it, right? That's it right there. That's what we do. That's how we touch each other in very simple, dynamic, precious ways, right? We relax our hearts, we relax our minds, we relax our ideas, and we reach out and don't know because I would have had no idea when I started walking towards the park what would happen. None whatsoever. But I'm like, it's a happy day. And that's it. It's 20. You have some time. You have about 5 minutes. Okay, how about if I open it up for any questions that people have or comments in relationship to anything that's been said?
I appreciate the reminder to come back to the wisdom that's arising in my own body and mind. I can forget that so easily and just try and rely on other people, which is also great.
Mm-hmm.
But also sometimes I feel like the one person in the wilderness, and then it's like, oh wait, no, I'm not.
Thank you. Kim.
I'm wondering how to balance the tension between feeling the truth that I feel coming up and delusion. Am I deluded? Am I deluded? Everyone thinks this. Am I deluded? Or am I really speaking the truth? Can you talk about that? Trying to discern between those two.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it connects with what Leonard was saying, is that that's why I think that friends, good friends, the Buddha talks about good friends, Ananda, good friends, that's the Dharma, is having good friends. And that's the Sangha. And having that connection with each other so we can have conversations that are not superficial, that are really in the heart, where there's skin in the game, where we're really getting to know each other so we can check in with each other. This is my experience. What do you think? Not that I'm handing over my power to you. I'm not doing that. I'm just asking you. I'm trusting you. I'm trusting in our practice. I'm trusting in our connectedness that you will be honest with me about what it is that I'm thinking, the experience I had. So I just, that's what I'm learning right now. And yeah, is the value of connection. Thank you. Yes, Peter.
I just wanted to give voice to the concept of right view. It can be very tricky. I'm sure that people who are members of ISIS think that they have right view when they're in jihad. And they can justify it with the same dynamics that we justify right view in the Buddhist tradition. Also, the Buddhists in Myanmar, chasing out the Rohingya, have, on both sides, people are grounded in their own sense of right view. And so right view dynamically can be siding up, finding like-minded Sangha members who have the same view of something that is different or outside of our space. So that I think it's important in right view to get the 10,000-foot view of things, and maybe the global perspective, which doesn't make things right and wrong, but checks in with the moral precept. That's kind of our ground, right, in our belly center. And it checks those places where my right view is not your right view, becoming a conflict.
Thank you. Thank you. I just want to respond to actions versus the person. If we go around killing each other over our right view, that's just going to create more suffering. So I invite, just as you pointed out, in no way would I say that a cultish groupthink, herdthink is the way. That's not the way. And that's why we have good friends. That's why we have good friends who say, you know what? That action, it wasn't kind. And I'm a little concerned because I feel like there's some force on it. So that's why we have good friends. And it's all about discerning with wisdom. So thank you. Yes.
As soon as you have a thought, you've left a naked experience.
Mm.
And so I've been really thinking a lot about how analyzing things, right, wrong, this, that, that that separates us from the naked experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then oftentimes the right view comes up as an insight,
mm-hmm.
if we can connect with that naked experience instead
mm-hmm.
of being analytical about it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're sitting in the raw of that experience, sometimes things come up that are not manufactured or manipulated.
Yes.
Or whatever.
I know.
So
yes.
I've just been in my head thinking about
mm-hmm.
that. Like, as soon as you're thinking about it, you've left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I fully connect with what you're saying. I'm sorry to use this word. I'm going to use it, emptiness. When your mind is empty, and that doesn't mean that you're not standing in spiritual stability. You're standing in the silence of the ocean, which is vast. And from that ocean, wisdom naturally arises. And from that wisdom is a response, because you hear the call, you hear the suffering, and it takes that silence to respond in a way that liberates the suffering, because the person who is observing the suffering is also suffering. So the suffering is in connection with all of us. So I just invite us to take a journey down into the ocean and see what silence can do.